Om Sahana Bhagatu, Sahana Pranaktu, Sahaviryan Karapapahai, Tejasvina Patitamastu, Mavidvishabahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Vivaswat Prabhatam Yatarupamaksham. Vivaswat Prabhatam Yatarupamaksham. Prakranati na bhatam evam vivaswan. Prakranati na bhatam evam vivaswan. Yara bhata abhasyat yakshamekaha. Yara bhata abhasyat yakshamekaha. Sanityo palabdi suruko hamatma. Sanityo palabdi suruko hamatma. Should be okay now. Okay? Testing. Sunday. Vivaswat prabhatam yata rupam aksham prakranati na abhatam evam vivaswan yet abhataha abhasyati aksham ekaha saha nitya upalabdhi swarupaha aham atma. Yata, just as the aksham. Aksham means the eye, right? The eye prakranati, just as the eye perceives. Prakranati means to perceive, so to know. So just as the eye perceives rupam. Rupam aksham prakranati. So yata, aksham prakranati, just as the eye perceives rupam, form, which is vivaswat prabhatam, which is illumined by the sun. Okay? So just as the eye perceives form, which is illumined by the sun, na abhatam, not form, which is not illumined by the sun. The eye can only perceive form if it's illumined by the sun. It can't perceive form if the sun's not illumining it. Okay? Evam, in the same manner, vivaswan, the sun itself, Lord's sun. We'll see what they mean by this in a minute. The same way, the sun, which is ekaha, right? Illumined by whom? The sun, illumined by whom? Abhasyati aksham, causes the eyes to see, right? Illumines the eyes, makes the eyes shine. So that one by whom the sun, illumined by whom the sun makes the eyes see. Sa nitya upalabdhi swarupo atma. I am that self, right? That self whose nature is nitya upalabdhi swarupo, whose nature is consciousness, which is changeless. So, I am that changeless consciousness who illumines the sun, which allows the sun to illumine the eyes, which allows the eyes to see. Okay. This is a nice verse. It's a first. This verse is bringing in, really, it's bringing in Hiranyagarbha. So let's just see where this, the picture that's being, the verse is actually painting a picture of Ishvara, in a sense, and showing the Jiva-Ishvara relationship, the relationship between the Jiva, the individual, and Ishvara, the whole. The whole is the conscious, as the Lord, the conscious being. And so here, this is the vision for you to see. My eyes perceive form, right? And that perception of form is solely really dependent upon the sun. The sun's not there, my eyes are there functioning, but they can't see anything. So any form that's perceived is dependent upon the light of the sun. So now we have in this creation that we are experiencing within the box as an individual with sense organs perceiving form, hearing sound, Now just notice yourself as an individual within the total creation, and your sense organs are dependent, you know, on situation within the creation. Your eyes are dependent, obviously, upon the sun for them to work. Okay? Now, what is the sun dependent on for it to shine? So that's the jump that's being made. Now, in Upasana, in, like, say, if you were to read some of the, especially the Chandogya, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where there's a lot of Upasana, the sun is often viewed as the eye of the Lord, the eye of the creation. Okay? And so if we think of it like that, then this whole creation, right, which we call, from the standpoint of that of reflecting consciousness, we look at the whole creation as Hiranyagarbha. And the creation then itself reflects consciousness and has its own order to it. Okay, so I look at it like this. I'm just going, my mind's going back and forth into the Basha here, and I'm just trying to think about exactly how I want to unfold this. The creation itself is viewed as one unit. One unit means it consists of a series of laws, an infinite order that holds it together as one being. This one being, the sun, lights it up. Okay? The sun is the eye, like the eye of this one being. The wind is like the breath. Okay? The waters are likened to urine. The earth is likened to the feet. Right? So try to imagine this. It's a Upasana that's imagining the entire creation as a living being, right? An expression of a living being. And that living being is called the Adhishtatra, or the Adhishtata. We translate that as the presiding deity. Okay? So now when we see this sun, which is part of the total order of the creation, the sun itself holds a position in the creation. You know, for instance, all of the planets revolve around the sun. The sun illumines the creation. It provides light. There's many, many suns, but we'll just stick with our little galaxy here. It says the sun illumines the earth. Right? It provides all of the light for the earth. That is its job. It's called the Adhishtatra. It's the presiding deity. The sun, then, in terms of this whole creation, which is a manifestation of order, this sun has a task, and the task is to illumine the earth. Okay? So now, in terms of the whole creation, this presiding deity, the sun is the presiding deity of the, is the presiding deity actually considered the presiding deity of all of the eyes? Because without the sun as the presiding deity, the eyes can't function. Does everybody follow that? For example, you have to kind of anthropomorphize everything in a sense. But not as a creation that has hands and legs, not like that. But think of the whole infinite creation and its functions. And you make a certain parallel to the function, like we breathe. The whole creation has wind, it has air, right? We see, the creation has the sun, that type of thing. So it's in a way, it's a type of anthropomorphism. Now, see this relationship. If I look at the whole infinite universe, and say just within our sphere, the earth and the sun is the presiding deity of sight, because without it, sight can't take place. We could say the wind, Vayu, is the presiding deity of the breath. So one is looking at a function of air or wind on a cosmic level, on a total level, and then you look at it also on an individual level. So the breath, the wind. Okay? Urine, rain. Okay. I'm sorry. That's what it is.
Oh, no.
But, it goes into great detail. Why, though? Because what it's trying to make you understand is that you are an individual being. You have capacities. You have sense organs. You have your eyes that are capable of seeing form. You have ears. You have the sense of touch. Right? You have a sense of taste. You have the sense of smell. You have a mind. You are a conscious entity that has these capacities. What the Upanishad wants you to do is to now see the entire creation as a conscious entity that has capacities. Just as you have organs, the creation has organs. You have the sense of sight, the creation has the sense of sight. So what it's trying to do is make you go from this individual that you experience as a single entity made of many parts, and take this individual entity and extend it now to understanding this creation as not an individual entity, but as a total entity, of which the individual is a part. Okay, so now, with this individual entity, you notice that your eyes are capable, they have the capacity to illumine form, to see form. There's a subject-object relationship there. When we go into the seer-seen differentiation, so he's going a different route this time, but I'm going to take you through this route and then go back and redo the route the way that Hastamalika is doing it. But I want you to appreciate this route first. When you recognize my eyes are capable of seeing forms, that is a fact. Okay? But it is also a fact that my eyes are also an object of my knowledge, because I know that the eyes themselves are working or not working. So these eyes are not only capable of seeing form, I am capable of seeing them, right? And so you can say, using this word adhishtatra, what we translate as presiding deity, which I want to kind of give you a sense of what this word means, because it's kind of hard to translate in English, so I have to give you the feeling for this adhishtatra. You can say that these eyes, you know, are the presiding deity of form. But my mind is the presiding deity of the eyes. Now, another way you can translate presiding deity, adhishtatra, is the conscious being. Right? Just the conscious being, the person, the being. So now, using that word for the time being. If I think of my eyes in reference to form, my eyes are the conscious being, right? And the form is the object of which I'm conscious of. Just looking at form, right? Eyes and form. So the conscious being, the presiding deity, the knower, right? Goes to the eyes, and the known goes to the form. But now, once I recognize that my eyes, yes, they're the adhishtat, they're the presiding deity of form, because they're responsible for the perception of form. However, it doesn't stop there. I can go in a step where my mind becomes the presiding deity, right? The conscious being of the eyes. The conscious being, the one who is conscious of the eyes. The eyes are conscious of the form, but the mind is conscious of the eyes. If you think you're not, then you know, though, if you're losing your sight or if your sight is 20/20, you also know that your eyes must, that your mind must use the eyes in order for the eyes to see, right? In other words, if you're daydreaming, your eyes are there, but your mind is not using the eyes, so the eyes don't see. And so the mind then becomes the presiding deity, right? The conscious being, the knower of the eyes. So the eyes now have, in a sense, been demoted. Right? They get to be the adhishtatra in reference to form, but then they have somebody above them, okay? And that's the mind. Now the thing is, though, the mind itself, which is the adhishtatra, the presiding deity of the eyes, and that stands for all sense organs, it also is known. Because it is known, it itself now is not ultimately the adhishtatra, the presiding deity, because there is a conscious being that illumines it. See? Because the mind is known. And so the conscious being does not ultimately stop at the mind. So the adhishtatra, the presiding deity, keeps moving inward, 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 until we get really to the consciousness, the conscious being, that can no longer be objectified. Right? So now, when does this stop? When does the presiding deity, when does it hit itself? Yeah, the Atma, right? The self, the consciousness itself, which cannot be objectified. Right? And so when you're at the level of your sense organs, you're at the level of instruments. We don't often think about it like that, but in fact, your sense organs are instruments that you use. You use your ears to hear, you use your eyes to see. They're instruments. And they have their range, right? So they are the presiding deity over their range. My eyes are the presiding deity over form, over color. My ears are the presiding deity of sound. But you've got to move inward from that. Then we get to the mind, presiding deity of all of the five sense organs. And that mind has to be using. That's the thing. The mind is a more all-encompassing instrument, right? But it is an instrument that you use. You use it to think. You use it to perceive. You use it to daydream. You use it to feel, right? But all of these functions of the mind are also illumined. You can also shut the mind down. You can go to sleep. You can meditate. You can make the mind very quiet. So it also is an instrument. So this idea of the presiding deity continues to move in until you get to consciousness itself, your being itself. And then the question comes up, well, you're at consciousness. Is there not a presiding deity to that consciousness? No, that would be infinite regress. Because consciousness, aware of consciousness, aware of consciousness, there's no difference. There's no subject-object relationship for consciousness to be the presiding deity of itself. Right? And so the presiding deity, right, the conscious being, stops at the conscious being when there is no longer something to objectify. You have to wait.
I don't know if you take questions.
I don't.
You don't?
No.
Okay.
But I'll give you a chance afterwards.
Sure.
Yeah, about half an hour, so just note it. So now we go all the way through in that regard. Now, going from sense organs to mind to self. Okay, so that's clear, that route of the presiding deity. Now, Hastamalika has gone a slightly different route. Okay, and he's gone the Katha Upanishad that we just finished, did one unfoldment like this that went at this route also. So let's look at the route using presiding deity. He looks like this. Okay, the eyes are really the presiding deity of the forms, right? But the sun is the presiding deity of the eyes. Because without the sun, so it's not going to the mind here, we're still here in the world. We're here in the world. We're here in perception, right? The act of perception. So instead of now going from the eyes to the mind, as the mind being that which lights up the eyes, which is true, he looks at it this way. These eyes can't function at all without the sun. Okay. Now that means that there's the sun, the eyes are totally dependent on their functioning on something which is much different and other than themselves. And so that means there's a relationship now between the sun, which lights up the earth, right, just to keep it small, the sun which lights up the earth, and the eyes which see form. And so now there's a relationship between the individual and the total. There's a relationship between the individual and the creation, with the individual eyes that see form, and the total creation with the sun that illumines the form so that the individuals can see it. You see that? And so now Hastamalika says, it is the sun now who is really the presiding deity of the eyes, because the sun determines whether or not the eyes are allowed to see. When the sun is up, the eyes can see. When the sun is down, the eyes can't see. Even if the mind is backing them, Doesn't matter, right? So now the sun is the presiding deity. Now the question comes, and do you see that there's a relationship now between the sun and the eyes? Because without the sun, eyes can't function. And we have eyes. See, this is another thing. We have eyes. And we have eyes so that we can see. But we can't see without the sun. And so the total creation is in harmony. The total creation is in harmony with the parts of the creation. So this individual is dependent, and these eyes are dependent upon the total in terms of the sun. So the sun now is really the adhishtatra of the eyes in this creation because they allow the eyes to see. But now the question is, who is the adhishtatra of the sun? Who created the sun? Who is the conscious being? Who is the creator of the sun that allows the eyes to see form? And so now we've gone from the individual to the total, and now he goes from the total to the self. That's the difference in the route. So he says, the adhishtatra of the self, so Hasan Malika makes this jump here, says, I am the adhishtatra of the sun, because of whom the eyes shine. Okay? Which allows, I am the adhishtatra of the sun, because I am the adhishtatra of the sun, and because of me, the sun, which causes the eyes to be able to see, abhasyati. Okay, so now that's the route. He's taking you to the self through that route. Now I have to show you why that's true. Okay, because there's a lot left out in that route. So, okay, so now. This is how we get to Ishvara, or the adhishtatra, the conscious being of the sun. Right? Because what Hasan Malika is saying, the author of this text, Hasan Malika is saying, I am the self of the sun. That's what it amounts to. Right? I am the self of the sun. I am the nitya upalabdhi surupa. I am the consciousness which is nitya, which is changeless, which is the self of the sun. Right? The sun, because of which these eyes are allowed to see. Okay? So that's where we are. I'm the self of the sun. How can I be the self of the sun? Well, when we go through this first route, right, where the sense organs are illumined as objects and instruments, right, which we know, it's a fact, they're known. The mind is an instrument. It's also objectified. It's also illumined. It is known. When I remove from myself, from consciousness, these objects that are illumined, right? Now let's do it like this. I remove myself from the illumined objects, seer seen relationship. It's like I remove from myself this rug. Remove means you understand the difference. If this rug is objectified by you, right, there's a subject-object relationship, it is known, and so I'm now making a differentiation between myself and the rug, which is known. I make that same differentiation, so the rug belongs to Ishvara, it belongs to the creation, it belongs to that which is illumined by the sun. Okay. This physical body is also objectified, it also is known by the same sense organs that illumine the rug, right? And so this also body is illumined by the sun, right? It's also objectified. It belongs to the creation, right? There's a subject-object relationship here. It is known. My sense organs, five sense organs, they also are known. The fact that they are known, this fact that they are known, I objectify, they change, I'm aware of them. What that does, that alone, puts them into the creation. They become part of the creation. The creation is that all that which is known. Does everybody see that? Anything that is known belongs within the time-space creation. So the body goes into the creation. It's part of the creation. Your sense organs are part of the creation because they are known. The mind is part of the creation because it is known. Every thought you have, every emotion, every mood, even the I thought, it belongs to the creation. So now, everything that is existing in your experience of knownness actually is part and parcel of this one creation, you know. We can say if it's on a physical level, what exists as the sun. The sun illumines that physical creation. And we would say on a subtle level, you know, this infinite mind, this mind which is illumined, belongs what? Well, it belongs to the creation because it exists within time and space. My mind, right, is different from your mind, is different from your mind, is different from your mind. And so it has to go too. It has to go now into the subtle creation. Okay? Because if there's this subtle mind and that subtle mind and that subtle mind and that subtle mind, and we all interact together, so we say that there's also an infinite order for the mind. Why do we consider the mind subtle? Why do we even make it different from the physical? Well, because we experience it as different. I see things physically through my eyes, but I can think through my mind. I can daydream through my mind. I can have dreams. I can have imaginations which are not of a physical order. So we make a differentiation between the physical and the subtle, just because we can use them differently. So you have imagination, you have imagination, you have imagination, you have thought flow, right? You have dreams. Everybody does. And it's all following a certain order. That's why we can communicate. That's why I can say to you, you have an imagination and so do I. And you can say, yes, that's true. You dream, yes, that's true. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. Yes, that's true. We can talk about our dreams. And so there's a subtle order which all humans enjoy, you know. And so that's what we call the subtle order of which one mind is a part. Why do we say that one mind is a part of this subtle order? Because it's objectified, right? That's what I mean by a part. It is known. Your mind is known, my mind is known, your mind is known, your mind is known, all minds are known. So that means that they belong to the creation, which we, if we want to divide, we can say the subtle aspect of the creation. Physical aspect of the creation is that we perceive through our sense organs. Nevertheless, they belong to the creation because they are objectified. Right? Even your I thought is objectified. I think I am doing this, I am doing that. You think I am doing this, I am doing that. I am thinking, I am listening, all of these things. Right? We're experiencing all of these things. They all belong to the creation. Who is creation? Yeah. Now, when you differentiate your being, the Atma, yourself, from these things which are illumined, each step of the way, each moment of differentiation, you are now released from the limitations. Your being is released from the limitations of that object that you have just removed from yourself. Right? And so say, when you recognize that your being illumines, is the sun, in fact, is the Adishtatra, is the conscious being of this body, illumines this body, then this body becomes an object of the creation, as are all bodies. My being is now not subject to the limitations of these physical bodies. So what? This body is known, 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 all of the bodies are known. Consciousness now is not of this form. The me that I thought to be of this form, as an upadhi, as a conditioning adjunct, is not of this form. This is known. It's exactly the same with your mind. The thoughts are known. One thought is known, next thought is known, next thought is known. For you, thoughts are known, 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 thoughts are known. For all these thoughts are known. What is to differentiate the consciousness that illumines those thoughts? Nothing. Right? Because the thoughts differentiate themselves, but the luminary, the Adishtatra, the conscious being, is not going to be differentiated by what it illumines. Just like the one sun illumines all of these forms. One sun illumines all of the forms. The sun, as a luminary, is not differentiated by the forms that it illumines. Myself, the conscious being, is not differentiated by the forms that I illumine. But that means that I not only illumine the conscious being that I am, not only illumines this form, it illumines your form, and your form, and your form. It not only illumines this mind, it illumines your mind, and your mind, and your mind, and your mind. It illumines all minds. And so that the conscious being, when we get down to just myself that cannot be objectified, then this one sun, in a sense, is the one sun illumining all beings, the one sun illumining all forms. And so here with Hastamalika, he goes to the sun that illumines the self and then sees the sun, that luminary, as the sense organs of the total mind, which itself is illumined, right? The sun itself is illumined. Now that's interesting. It's through the Shruti that we recognize the whole infinite creation as that which as being self-luminous. What does that mean, that this whole infinite creation is self-luminous? I'm not talking about consciousness now. By self-luminous, I mean that the whole creation reflects the self. What that means is like this. Your mind, which has many thoughts, many feelings, many textures, right? Your mind, which is known, also experiences itself as conscious, right? Even though when you analyze the mind, it is known, right? That's what you end up with. When you analyze the mind, it's just that every single thought in the mind, every experience in the mind is known. There isn't even an experience of a knower, really. When you get into the actual analysis of the mind, what you recognize is that the thought modification itself is known. And the next thought is known. And the next thought is known. And the ahankara thought that says, I know the thought, that also is known. Right? So really, experientially, all you have here in reference to this mind is it is known. Now, what about the entire infinite creation? Is the infinite creation, the whole time-space creation, that is illumined by the sun, okay? Like the mind, is it known? Again, just like in analyzing your own experience of the mind, there is really no knower. The knower comes from the fact that the mind is known. And then you label the consciousness in reference to the mind itself as the knower, and you label the consciousness in reference to the objects in the mind as the known. But if you just sit there, you say, yes, this mind is known, therefore I'm the knower. Try to find the experience of the knower apart from the known. And so really, all the way through, if I say, like, this wall is known that I'm looking at, the wall is known, the space intervening is known, the body is known, the sense organs are known, the mind is known, consciousness is known. Yes, consciousness is known, but there's no knower behind it. So knownness is the very nature of consciousness. Does the creation enjoy itself like an infinite vritti, infinite thought modification, infinite mind, enjoy knownness? What we can say, just as a jiva, as an individual, based upon our own immediate analysis of our experience, is this. Note the experience of knownness. That this is known, this is known, this is known, my mind is known. The experience of knownness is the nature of the Atma, is the Atma. That is consciousness, awareness. The experience of knownness is awareness itself. It is consciousness itself. So the knownness that everything in our experience enjoys, belongs to consciousness is consciousness. That belongs to consciousness is consciousness. And so, yes, the entire creation, because that consciousness, okay, that consciousness doesn't belong to any object in the creation, therefore consciousness is free of time and space and objectivity, and so limitless in that way, therefore there is in fact nothing away from knownness. Okay? There can be nothing away from knownness. So absolutely everything enjoys knownness. Everybody with me so far? Because there is nothing else but knownness. Okay? But now the question comes, yes, but. Okay. This is the yes, but. This mind enjoys itself the knownness. Well, actually it doesn't, but I'm going to talk that way for a while. Okay? Because this mind enjoys an experience of being known, but I don't think the lamp enjoys an experience of being known. The lamp doesn't seem to have a subtle body, or the chair doesn't seem, it's not complaining that I'm sitting on it, as Swamiji sometimes jokes, you know, get off, you're too heavy. the chair doesn't seem to have a subtle body, or it does not seem to have a mind that is enjoying the experience of being known, or the rug, etc. You know, so, how do we know that the infinite creation is not more like a chair with conscious minds walking through it? Now we can say easily now, get this far, that the consciousness, the experience of knownness, this me-ness, this very personal me, that experience of knownness is infinite. There's nothing away from it, right? Because it doesn't belong to an object. There's no object that can possibly be away from it. Okay? Because it's not limited by body, mind, sense organs, etc. But how do we know? We can say that because of that, the whole infinite creation cannot be away from that, because that limitless, non-objectifiable knownness has no limits. But how can we say, so the whole creation is going to enjoy that, just by that logic. How do we know, though, that the entire infinite creation reflects consciousness, and that it's not like an inert space or inert chair, something like that, with conscious dots in it? If it's like that, then we wouldn't say this creation is Ishvara, that this creation is a conscious being, right? We would say there is Brahman, which is pure consciousness, pure conscious being, limitless conscious being, and then this limitless conscious being projects this Maya creation, which is Mother Nature, but is, from its own standpoint, inert. Am I making this argument clear? I don't know if I am or not, but anyway. It's because it's not known from its own standpoint. The knownness just belongs to the non-objectifiable self, right? It's not reflected. How do you know whether or not it's reflected or not? This is where the Shruti comes in. The Shruti says, the scripture, the Upanishads say, as a pramana, yes, it is reflected. Yes, Ishvara is a conscious being. That this creation that comes from the self, is sustained by the self, and resolves into the self, is one conscious being. And then they use an example. Just like, we always use it in any type of logic. In fact, you use drishtantas, what they call illustrations, to kind of fortify what they call the pratignya, the initial statement. Here the Shruti is making an initial statement which we have no means of knowledge to make. You're not going to have yourself, through your sense organs, an experience of Ishvara. You know, to know that this infinite creation is a whole. That this, in fact, this is, when Swamiji says, or when the Upanishad says, this is the whole, right? You are the whole, actually, is what he says. You are the whole. Means that the conscious being that you are manifests as this whole infinite creation that we call the Lord, that we call Ishvara. That there is only God, there is nothing but God. So the Shruti holds that. Then it gives, it presents it. Then it gives this as a this logics, but it gives this as an illustration, drishtanta. At night, when you have a dream, say you have a lucid dream, we'll just use the example of dream. You have a dream. When you have that dream, the entire dream universe, right, reflects awareness. The entire dream material, all of it, reflects awareness. Within that entire dream, there is the insentient rug and the insentient chair and the insentient lamp. But those things are insentient from their own standpoint. And then, of course, there'll be the birds and the bees and the individuals and the plants and the grass and, you know, living creatures. And in that dream, you'll have this differentiation between living creatures and inert things. The living creatures reflect awareness. The inert things don't. However, the entire dream does. The entire dream is known. And now as a dreamer, your experience will be, if you're identified with someone in the dream, say you're identified with a body in the dream, then you're experiencing the dream from the sense organs of that individual. If you're not identified with, there might be people in the dream, but if you're not identified with a person in the dream, then those people are experienced, but they're experienced as part of the whole. So, in fact, in your experience in the dream, you can go from experiencing the dream from within the dream through your sense organs, or you can be experiencing the whole and back and forth like that. You know? You can have just the whole dream experiencing the whole. So now, in the Upanishad, it says, you are the whole. I could say the same thing to you, the dreamer. To say there's a dream guru within the dream, and the dream guru says to the dream student, you are the whole. In reality, you know, you are this whole dream. Right? You are the self of the dream. You are the one from whom the dream comes, right? Who sustains the dream, and the one into whom the dream goes. In fact, you are the whole. There's nothing of this that is away from you in any way. Right? And so, in fact, we could say to the dream character, Ishvara means the Lord. So, in reality, the dreamer is the Lord of the dream. Everybody with me on that? The dreamer is Ishvara. The dreamer is the Ishvara of the dream. The dream guru can tell the dream character, the dream student, you are Ishvara. Because you are Ishvara, because it's from you, the conscious being, the Adhishtatra, the conscious being, that the whole dream comes. And that whole dream is known. And so the Upanishad view, so now let's look at, if you look, just stay with the dream for a minute. If the whole dream comes, then you can see how, where Hastamalika is coming from in his unfoldment, right? He's looking just from the standpoint of the eyes, right? The eyes in the dream are seeing the form, but they're seeing the form because of the sun. But I am the one who is the self of the sun, right? The sun is the Adhishtatra of the eyes, but I am the Adhishtatra, the conscious being of the sun. And so that's how he's showing in Mahavakya. He's going, the Mahavakya means that which says you are Ishvara. That's how he is going that route, you are Ishvara. But what's important here is that, and this is why epistemology, the understanding of how we know what we know, is so important. As a jiva, as an individual, you, with your means of knowledge, which have to do with your sense perception and presumption and and inference and what we call unimpulability, not being able to see an elephant in the room, all of these. There's six major means of sense organs, means of knowledge that we use in order for us to gain knowledge. All of that knowledge and all of the sophisticated inferences that we have and presumptions that we have based upon our means of knowledge, you know, allow us to go a long ways. But they don't allow you to go to that understanding to gain through your means of knowledge the relationship between the self and Brahman. That there is such a thing as Ishvara. Once the Upanishad takes you there step by step by step to make you see it, recognize it, because it's talking about that which is in your experience, to recognize, to see in a certain way. Once it reveals that, you know, then there's any amount of logic, any amount of what we call illustrations to substantiate it and make you see, give you that vision. But you can't get there on your own. And that's a very important understanding in terms of differentiating what Advaita Vedanta has to say and what schools, different schools and spiritual traditions have to say that don't rely upon the vision of the Upanishads. Because if you don't rely on what the Upanishads have to say as a means of knowledge, you have no way of getting there. You have no way of, you can imagine it, or you can say that this is what I believe it to be, but you don't have a legitimate means of knowledge to establish that. And so it becomes a very, very interesting. The Buddha understood this. And that's why when in his teaching, he put parameters around what he was willing to talk about. You know? And he put those parameters around because he didn't accept the Upanishads as a means of knowledge. And so even in, with a Vedantin, when a Vedantin will discuss with a Buddhist, when we do that traditionally, we will only talk with them and argue or debate with them or look at their issues, accepting the means of knowledge that they accept. How could we discuss with a Buddhist or with a Jain or a Charvaka, or Charvaka would be equal to our scientists? How can we have any type of discussion with them, you know, if on a level that they don't accept? So there's a lot of things to understand about, you know, what you can know and what you can't know. And if somebody is, say, arguing with what you have to say and doesn't accept the means of knowledge that you use, you can only argue with them on their own turf. Or it's meaningless. It's meaningless. And so say I was to argue with a Buddhist who had a certain unfoldment that they wanted to prove, and I disagreed with it. I would have to disagree with it on their terms and prove it to be false on their terms. Why would I want to prove it to be false? What do I care? Well, we don't really care. In some ways, we don't really care. We don't care if the person is a Buddhist or a Tibetan, or they're studying this or studying that, and they're in their own corners and they're studying and doing what they're doing. That's fine. We let them be. However, when you're teaching, when you're giving a teaching like this, every one of you is going to be a Buddhist. Every one of you is a Sankhya. Every one of you is a Charvaka in terms of this doubt or that doubt. Every one of you is a scientist. You know, in other words, each one of your doubts, each one of your conclusions, the way you think, is going to fall into one school or another. It doesn't matter what it is. And so we don't really care what the schools are. It's just that, is that a doubt that you have that is stopping you from understanding this knowledge? See what I mean? Do you because in order for knowledge to take place, what really is knowledge? Knowledge has got to match the object. So what would knowledge of reality be? It has to match reality. That's what it is. So say you have a doubt, there is no knowledge that can match reality. It's not possible to know reality. That's a doubt. Right? That becomes a question that needs to be dealt with. What is reality? What is the reality that you can't know? What is the reality you can know? What is the reality that you can't know? What falls within your... See, what? It's not stupid for you to say we can't know reality, because anybody in their right mind would know that of course we can't know reality, because any object is infinitely divisible. It comes from an infinite number of standpoints. How can you possibly know it? Yeah? It's not possible. You know, you go a million miles out into space, you can't even get there. You can't get to the ends of creation. You can't get to what is prior to creation. How can you know what happened before creation? How can you know what happens after creation? How can you know if there's heaven worlds or hell worlds? How can you know that with your means of knowledge? That's why all of these things are so important, you know? And what is the difference between scriptural knowledge? Why would anybody even think that there is such a thing as scriptural knowledge? What would ever make you even want to consider that? So these are all huge questions, you know. So we tackle what might be considered a Buddhist question or a Sankhya question or a Neo-Vedantin question, all these things. I'll tackle all of those things, but I would rather not call them Buddhist or Sankhya or label them like this. You know, I would rather just take the questions and give the answers and the unfoldment to those questions. Because nobody, usually at least that comes to my classes that I've met so far, has enough depth of knowledge in any given tradition to really be able to argue what that tradition says. But you might have your own doubts about what you've heard, you know, or what you think. You have your own doubts. And I also am not an authority in another tradition. Right? But I could speak with somebody who's an authority in a tradition, because they could tell me what their tradition says. They could tell me what they believe. They could tell me what they base their beliefs on, all of that. Then you can speak to them. But for us, we're not in that position. You know, you're probably, I don't think that any of you are in that position. If you are, that's fine. But I don't assume that anybody is in that position. You know, so then you just have to bring your own doubts. And whatever those doubts are, then we can deal with them. Right? But, you know, in the East, in India, and with Advaita Vedanta, liberation and freedom is knowledge. It has everything to do with knowledge, with removing ignorance. It doesn't have to do with, you know, attaining some great experience. It has to do with recognizing and gaining knowledge of the experience that's here right now. And your mind is the one that needs to gain that knowledge. Your mind needs to gain knowledge. Yourself is already here. Yourself, it doesn't have a problem. Yourself is fine. It's the mind that is entangled in all kinds of problems and notions. And this mind's got to sort through everything. And there's with Advaita Vedanta, I mean, it's a very thorough teaching tradition to unwind all of these problems, to sort through, to you know, just remove ignorance. That's what it does. It removes ignorance, removes ignorance, removes ignorance. You can say, well, it's not removing my ignorance. If it's not removing your ignorance, then it's not removing your ignorance. That's true. You're the one that needs to gain knowledge, right? And so it's your doubt that has to be, your personal doubt that has to be resolved. And the teacher can't resolve that for you, you know? So what I mean by that is, say you have a question, you have a doubt. And so you ask me in this situation, since I'm in this position at the moment, You ask me, you know. Then I try to resolve that doubt for you. I do just an unfoldment and to try to make you see that, to remove that doubt so you see it. Okay? So I do my best to remove that doubt. But I'm not removing the doubt. See what I mean? That has to happen for you. In your mind, you have to say, oh, yeah, I see that. Then you usually, I see that, but what about this? And then that'll be the next one. But the doubt has to be removed for you. And the doubt is removed by your seeing, by your understanding, by your note, by your seeing. Seeing in a way that you see, you get it, and there's not, and your mind is resolved around that point. And that process keeps going. You know, the vision of Vedanta reveals it, unfolds itself, and then you take care of levels and levels and levels and levels of doubt. Some of us, you know, when we were studying with Swamiji in India, the class would be over, and there were probably about 20 of us that would just be on his heels, following him all the way down to the where he would sit on the veranda, you know, and then answer our questions. You know, for half an hour, sometimes half an hour, an hour. I'd be one of the first people there. what about this, Swamiji? Well, I didn't quite understand that. What about this? And how could that be? And how could that be? So you would just sit there. And that's how it is. Because you would see something, but then my mind had all of these questions about it. And we should be able to answer those questions. You know, but you're the one that has to have the question resolved. In India, there's no running away from questions. You know, every question is a legitimate question. Right? And the mind has to have that absolute freedom. This isn't just for Vedanta. This is India. But it's very true for Vedanta. Your mind has to have the absolute freedom to question so that it can know. You know? And so that question or satsang, that question answer, is integral to the teaching itself. So if there's something the teacher can't answer for some reason, you just don't, like say you ask me something and I don't know, well, I'll find out what it is. Say, oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure of that. That'll be one of the things that I really get on to Swamiji. But there's nothing wrong with that. If something stymies me, I'd be the first one to want to figure that out. We have to have that total freedom to ask. And that's another whole notion that you think that, oh, that your mind can't know. This is beyond your mind. Well, your mind's the one that's got the problem. And the mind's the one that has to understand and come to a resolution. There's a lot of stuff that has to be sorted through here. So, well, that's enough. Let's take just a moment. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. You know how we say it? We can say it like that. But it can get a little bit confusing because we think of it like there's a subtle mind separate from the physical universe. Even though we can make that distinction. If you think of Ishvara as just Brahman, consciousness, plus the Maya capacity, right? The instant The universe projects, that's Hiranyagarbha. Right? Because as soon as there's duality, there's consciousness of that. So the aspect of consciousness which the creation enjoys is what we call Hiranyagarbha.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so another way we can say it is the creation projects as the five subtle elements and then goes through a process of panchikarana where it goes through this process of grossification. But, you know, that's kind of like a linear thing. So if you just look at the moment of the projection, that's Hiranyagarbha. So the conscious aspect of the creation.
Okay. Now, this, you know, so what I, the way I understood this teaching is that just as I'm a conscious entity.
The way you understood it from me, or you understood it from yourself? Or?
From you.
Okay.
I'm trying to rephrase it in my
own. Oh, okay, I understand.
I have
yeah.
a question about it.
Okay.
So, then, and the self, or the actual consciousness, is the self.
Yes.
Is Atma. Then the universe is also a conscious entity as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And itself is Brahman. Right?
So far.
So, no, well.
Well, I'm waiting for you to say that that Atma.
Ultimately, Atma and Brahman
are one.
There,
it's not that they're like each other, that they're, Atma is Brahman. In fact, right. that is the Mahavakya. That it's not that Atma is part of Brahman,
mm-hmm.
but you recognize that your self mm-hmm. is infinite
right.
and is the self of the whole creation.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I guess I'm sort of still hung up on this epistemological thing of that it's dependent on Shruti. I mean, I could see that.
It's not that it's not logical or experiential, but to get... But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah, because I guess that's the thing, is that it's just, to me, you know, like there's certain things in science that aren't quite there yet but seem to be hinting at this sort of thing, like the Gaia hypothesis, and, you know, this Earth is a living entity, and various forms of systems theory and stuff like that. I don't know enough about that.
Everything hints at it.
It hints at it, yeah.
Yeah, everything hints at the creation being a conscious
exactly.
being. Right.
And then I also, so I think that, so then it leads me to think that it might be possible to actually come to that without being dependent on the Shruti. And then the other question I have about that is, I don't know why this matters to me that much, but I'm just, is where did the, you know, how did the rishis get this?
You know, the knowledge itself is looked at as beginningless, as the creation is beginningless. And so it's not like there was a first rishi. You know, this is kind of an interesting thing to try to grapple with. If Brahman, consciousness, itself is what we call nitya, it's changeless, not beginningless. It's a, beginningless gives us a sense of continuity, where changeless or timeless gives us a sense of always being as it is. It's not. Do you see what I'm saying? If you say beginningless, it's true. Brahman is beginningless. It's beginningless because it's changeless. It's beginningless because it's not subject to past, present, or future. So for Brahman, there's never been any type of change or modification or becoming in any way. The Maya, you know, which you can't place any place else but in Brahman because there is nothing else, but Maya is not, there is no other thing, but Maya is not looked as an attribute of Brahman at all, as though there's some sort of a connection there, but then it's not away from Brahman either. Okay, so Maya is dependent, in fact, on Brahman. Okay, that Maya is beginningless. It has no cause. It didn't come into being. There is no first creation. If there's no first creation, there's no first rishi. There's no first knowledge. There's no first Hiranyagarbha.
Okay.
You see what I mean? So the knowledge itself, the Vedic knowledge itself, is considered to be a natural expression of Ishvara, of Hiranyagarbha. Not that there is a human being in the form of a rishi and this knowledge flowed down through. Even though some people have said that, that's more of a Neo-Vedanta, that's not. Now, if you want to read, again, Anantananda Ram Bachchan wrote an interesting argument on this in English. You can find all of this in the Sanskrit, but he wrote it in his first book called Accomplishing the Accomplished. It's a chapter 4 of that book. And he's very good because he's meticulous, and he also studied Advaita Vedanta with Swamiji for years. And he studied traditionally in the Sanskrit. So he knows all of these things and has kind of meticulously worked through them. So he does a nice unfoldment of this. But I'm giving it to you right now, okay? And it's just basically that there is no beginning. There is no first creation. There is no first rishi. There is no first knowledge.
Well, okay, so it's basically then from that point of view, the Shruti is also
beginningless. That's right. It's Ishwara. It's not separate from Ishwara.
That's totally not.
Yeah. That's right.
That's amazing, yeah.
It's amazing. It's beautiful, actually. Yeah. It's beautiful.
I'll have to meander it here to get to my exact question, but the understanding is that consciousness could only exist because it needs an object. In other words, there's no consciousness without an object.
Of course, we don't say that. Advaita Vedanta won't say that.
It won't say that.
No, because of this. When you differentiate consciousness from the object, if you remove the object, nothing happens to consciousness.
Right.
So there's no dependence. Now, if you're within the creation and you're talking from the standpoint of an instrument, like your sense organs or the mind, then there's this reciprocal relationship.
Right. Okay.
But consciousness illumines both the knower and the known.
Okay, so putting it this way, from the perspective of an individual ego, there's a regression where each object in turn becomes a subject back to a point where there's a whole that can't be an object, and therefore it can't know itself, and there's a...
Almost. When you get back, that's you're right up to this point. Say this regression going, as you call it, going this backwards differentiation, right? The eyes become an object. The eyes that were a subject become an object.
Exactly.
The mind that was a subject becomes an object. Now you get to, finally, you get to just consciousness itself. Consciousness now cannot illumine consciousness as an object, right? So there's not going to be a subject-object relationship here, but consciousness is self-effulgent. Right? Consciousness is its own experience. So that's the only little... maybe you were saying that, but I wanted to make that more clear.
No, I think I understood that part. Where I got confused, and it probably is my interpretation, is it sounded at a point like you were equating being with consciousness.
I was.
Okay, you were.
Yeah.
Okay.
Being and consciousness are one and the same. In fact, just as being, your own self-experience of existence, I am, I exist,
right,
that is not objectifiable either. So both consciousness and being are not objectifiable. So there's no way to differentiate the one from the other. So we say that existence is consciousness and consciousness is existence.
Okay, so one might say, like a coin has heads and tails, there's one coin and just...
But there's not two sides. It's
right,
that,
right. It's an illusory.
It's illusory. It's that, really, consciousness is a word that points to something, and existence is a word that points to something.
Gotcha.
And that something is the self, is Atma. So Atma is both Sat, consciousness, and Chit. Have you heard that term, Sat, Chit, Ananda? Yeah. So what that says is the Atma, the self, is Sat, which is Chit. It is existence, which is consciousness, which is Ananda, means limitless, really. Sat, Chit, Ananda. It is limitless existence, consciousness. And each word is pointing to the one non-dual Atma.
Okay.
So yeah, consciousness is existence.
Okay. So as soon as I apply a concept to Satchitananda, then I've created duality and
yeah. As soon as you're within duality, in fact, whenever there's a subject-object relationship, Whenever there's time, space, anything within time, space, there's duality there.
And then I'm identified with something. Like when you talked about knowledge, it's pushing back the frontiers of the things that I'm identified
That's
with.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. That's right. This body gets thrown into the creation. Sense organs are put into the creation. Mind is put into the creation. I thought is put into the creation. And what's left is such shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. 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 Good.
Any distinction then between awareness and consciousness?
No.
Okay.
We use them only as synonymous. Yeah. And we use them, we use both terms because your mind can get stuck on one term. Like consciousness, you know, you can think of in conscious of something, awareness is a little bit more abstract, and so we can go back and forth. But all of them are just words for consciousness.
So why have two words, sat and chit? I mean, they made that distinction.
Oh, well.
Initially.
Because your a priori experience, the bottom line experience that's accepted by every human being is I am, I exist, and I am a conscious being. So you experience your existence and your consciousness. Also, in reference to this creation, because not everything is equally conscious, right? Because everything doesn't reflect consciousness. The rug doesn't reflect consciousness like the human being does. But look at this. In this thought modification that you're seeing this room through your eyes, okay? So you're getting a thought modification of the room. Everything you can say, it is, 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 it is. Everything gets it. Being. Do you see that? Everything gets existence.
So from, I'm probably using the wrong terminology for the frame, but from an ontological level, there's no distinction, but from any particular phenomenological perspective, then there is a distinction, but it's an illusion of that particular point of view.
It's an illusory distinction because actually the existence that is being enjoyed by the universe is only one non-objectifiable being. And that non-objectifiable being is my own amness. And this being, the amness that I experience, is then superimposed under everything in the creation is it is and you are and it is and it is. Now, equally superimposed is it is known, right? Just like everything is, everything also is known. But the is knownness, this knownness experience is awareness. But we say, I can say I'm aware of everything. I like to say everything is known, putting the self is known. That's the self-effulgent nature. And absolutely everything enjoys that. And even as the things come and go, right? Like, say everything here changed. Then whatever's here is known, right? Whatever's here is known. The isness and the is-knownness don't ever modify at all. The objects modify. That's because the isness and the is-knownness are is the such it. It's the nature of the Atma, which is changeless being. Which is Brahman, which is really the changeless being of the entire creation.
So it appears like, if I'm understanding it right, being always means, I'm getting lost in language, but being always means being, but consciousness is very much relative. Consciousness equals being when you pull yourself out of the relative world. Otherwise, you need another word for it if you're speaking from a relative perspective.
That's right, because from a relative perspective, everything is, but not everything is conscious.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So that's why it's so tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's why all of these objects have to be kind of thrown in, and then you realize, well, we say like this, yeah, it's not that everything is, but not everything is conscious. Yes, but everything is, and everything is known. And that, when you say that, now you've withdrawn, you've thrown these objects of knowledge into the pot. The body is known, sense organs are known, mind is known, I thought is known, everything is known.
Except for the whole.
Well, except for the whole. That's because you have a limited mind and sense organs, and you can't have a thought modification of Ishvara. Right? That's why you need a revealed means of knowledge to even know the nature of Ishvara, because you have no means of getting there. You can appreciate it, But how can you, and you can see in terms of you create the creation, this seems like a sentient being, and you have so many experiences that show that there's just different types of, what do you call, in synchronicities and experiences that show there's an underlying network of consciousness, but to know that this entire infinite creation is Ishwara, is a conscious being. What's your means of knowledge for that? So that becomes an interesting discussion.
Yeah.
And the for us, the Shruti is the means of knowledge for that. And then there's a lot of, once you gain that knowledge, Upanishadic vision, then there is a lot of logic and experience that will substantiate that. But you didn't get there on your own.
Can't we say that objects throughout the universe reflect different upadis, have different abilities to reflect consciousness?
Yeah.
For instance, an atom has to be somewhat responsive to the parts within the atom.
Yeah.
Animals, whatnot. So they don't have self-consciousness. They cannot go anywhere towards an awareness of their consciousness, but yet they're reflecting interrelatedness and responsiveness.
I don't know. In this sense, I don't know how to what degree everything is an individual sukshma sharira, subtle body. Like, for instance, your subtle body, we could say a plant is a subtle body, an insect is a subtle body, an amoeba is a subtle body, you know, which means as an entity it reflects consciousness. But we don't really say that the lamp has a subtle body. And so what I'm saying is when you go into the microscopic levels of the creation, what has a subtle body as a living entity and what doesn't? They don't get that. They don't go that far in the Upanishads to know. I mean, where does the jiva stop? Where are the individual jivas, life forms that enjoy sentiency themselves from their own standpoint? So I just don't know.
So that would be just maybe responding to cosmic laws, things like that. If we're thinking on an atomic level. Something like that, as opposed to...
We would think of it definitely as part of Ishwara,
right.
Part of the infinite order of the creation.
Right.
But which parts are... which collections of matter have sukshma shubhivas that make them a unique individual entity? We don't go very far into that, because it's not necessary to get the overall vision.
Kind of a semi-challenge or doubt is something like I combine subatomic particles, I get atoms, I combine atoms, I get molecules. And at each level, I get certain emergent qualia, perhaps one of them being consciousness. If ultimately... everything is of the same substance in the phenomenological world, there's an implication that whatever is an emergent at a particular level existed at least as a potentiality. And it sounds like you're making the argument that, you know, something like a hunk of matter or a hunk of coal, that somehow that quality of a subtle mind, for example, to be outside of space, but not necessarily outside of time, because there's a linearity to it. How could that argument be made? Because how could consciousness or that emergent arise from something where the potentiality wasn't there to begin with, like in matter?
No, I understand what you're saying. Say if there's one non-dual consciousness. In fact, that non-dual consciousness is not away from anything. It's the very being of everything. Now the question is, in this manifest universe, which we will call Ishwara, not even, just forget about there even being any individuals, the whole thing is just Ishwara. Now we say, within this manifest creation, at what point does a given collection of things reflect consciousness? You know, I don't know.
Right.
At whatever point it does, then we would call that a jiva.
And that's not consciousness in the ultimate sense. That's consciousness in the relative sense.
It's a consciousness in the relative sense.
Because the consciousness of my mind could be an object, and therefore it's an object of something else that stands behind it.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. And so at what point does something in the creation reflect consciousness to make it a living being? There's more to it also. There's other dimensions that we call, because we in Vedanta and in India, just generally, we look at the transmigration of the jiva also. In other words, this is just one birth of many. And so the jiva entity is always something which is reflecting consciousness, and it will take birth after birth after birth, dependent on karmas. So your prior karmas. And so now that's getting into a whole nother dimension of how this creation works.
So like in this system, because I'm not an expert at it or anything,
yeah.
Like a jivatman, if there's the notion of a jivatman, would that be where the last locus of individuality touches the infinity?
Well, in the teaching, this idea of a jivatma, okay, what you discover through this teaching, that the jivatma is Brahman, that there is no individual atma at all, but there's a transmigrating mind, sense organs, subtle body that takes body after body after body, that because of self-ignorance takes itself to be the conscious being. And so that's what gives for the illusion of a jivatma, right? Because in reality, that conscious, the one that's transmigrating, the atma that it enjoys is never transmigrating. The atma that it enjoys is just one atma from which the whole creation has come.
So in a sense, the jivatman is the last illusion.
Yes, in this sense, I would say, or the first illusion, maybe the first illusion from one standpoint.
Right, first identification.
It's the first
subtle identification.
And what it is the ahankara, the I notion of the mind, saying, "I am the atma." So it identifies the mind with the self,
yeah,
which is not transmigrating. The self, which is myself, is yourself. But the jivatma, the jiva, says, "I am me and you are you."
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's a false identification. And so really, there is no jivatma. The jivatma is a product of ignorance. It's the mind saying, you know, "I am me and you are you." Not recognizing that the I that this mind enjoys is the I
yeah.
that your mind enjoys.
Yeah, you just cleared up a long-standing question for me, because it seemed like a performative contradiction to...
What is performative?
It contradicts itself in what it asserts.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
it would. How's this side of the room doing?
My apologies. I'm a virgin. And I'm sorry, I'm not like.
I'm teasing. It was a really nice discussion. I was joking. All right. Let's call it a night. Okay. Okay, good.